Houston, we have a podcast. Welcome to the official podcast of NASA's Johnson Space Center, episode 398, Artemis II, the Orion spacecraft. I'm Kenna Pell, and I'll be your host today. On this podcast, we bring in the experts, scientists, engineers, and astronauts, all to let you know what's going on in the world of human spaceflight and more. Built to take humans farther than they've ever gone before, Orion is NASA's spacecraft capable of crewed flight to deep space and high-speed re-entry from the vicinity of the moon. On the Artemis II mission, Orion will be tested for the first time in space with humans on board. It'll send NASA astronauts Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, and Christina Koch, and Canadian Space Agency astronaut Jeremy Hansen around the moon and bring them home safely. This deep space capsule is built upon everything learned from NASA's past 50-plus years of human spaceflight missions and uses new and advanced technologies to enable it to travel farther into space than any other crewed spacecraft in history. On this episode, we bring in Chris Edelin, the acting manager of the Orion program's office responsible for the spacecraft systems integration and analysis. He'll tell us all about the spacecraft and what we can expect from humanity's return to the moon aboard Orion. Let's go.
T-minus 5 seconds and counting. Mark. Mission start. T-0. Launch commit light circle.
Here she goes.
Houston, we have a podcast.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, hi, Kenna. Thanks for having me.
Let's hear about your journey to NASA. And let's start from the beginning. Where are you from, and did you have an interest in space or NASA as a kid?
Yeah, I'm from a small town in southwestern Virginia called Martinsville, and grew up there and was interested in space and aviation from an early age. One of my earliest memories is during the Apollo missions. I can remember seeing the TV coverage and walking outside the house and looking up to the moon, and just my mind was blown that, thinking, wow, there's two people on the moon and another person orbiting the moon. So I was sort of hooked at an early age, and that sort of set my path for the future.
Okay, wow. Full circle, speaking of going around the moon and now working in the Orion program. What did you go to school for?
Yeah, so as I was growing up, again, just reading everything I could get my hands on about aviation, space flight. I got my pilot's license when I was 17. And when I was in high school, the space shuttle launched. And so followed closely with all those missions and decided then that I was going to try to pursue a degree in aerospace engineering. So I got accepted into Virginia Tech and went to school there. And my freshman year, on a help wanted bulletin board, the chief scientist for NASA Langley Research Center was going to be coming to Blacksburg to interview people. So
perfect.
I was like, oh, wow, I've got to get my resume ready, and
yeah.
I applied for that, and then imagine my excitement when I got hired. And so I was 19 years old, the fall of the beginning of my sophomore year. I was working part-time at NASA Langley in Hampton, Virginia. So cooperative education is where you alternate, a semester of school with a semester of work. So take an extra year to graduate to do that, but really enjoyed doing that, and again, learned a lot more about space and aviation, and decided while I was in school that I would try to get on with Johnson Space Center out here in Houston because I wanted to be part of the space shuttle flight operations. And
okay.
So that's what I did.
Super cool. I didn't realize you were at Langley before.
Yeah. So when I came out to JSC right after graduation, mm-hmm. I started as a checklist book manager for the shuttle ascent checklist. And then within a couple of years, I'd worked my way into the Mission Control Center, which is where I really wanted to be. I was working in the one of the multi-purpose support rooms or the back rooms for the Flight Dynamics Officer, or FIDO. And after a couple years in the back room, I worked my way up to the front room. And so, I found myself supporting about 34 missions as a FIDO during the shuttle program.
Wow.
And, thinking back to being that high school kid watching the shuttle launch for the first time, and then being in mission control, sending up commands, to uplink the state vector for the space shuttle, or guiding it into rendezvous with the space station, or bringing it back to the runway, runway landing at Kennedy Space Center, mm-hmm. or Edwards Air Force Base. Yeah, that was just it was literally a dream come true for me.
So, how did you transition from being a FIDO to flight director, and then ultimately your position now?
Yeah, as I became more experienced as a FIDO, I served as a lead flight controller on several missions, and so every console, every discipline in the control center has a lead that works starting a year or two in advance of the mission, working with the lead flight director to plan, what are the objectives of the mission? What are the unique requirements? Do we need new procedures, special hardware or analysis to accomplish the mission? And then we work closely with the astronauts, with the shuttle program at the time to plan that mission and bring it into being. And then you go and you train during simulations and go fly it. So it's a great experience to be a lead. And so doing that, I worked more and more closely with the flight directors, mm-hmm. and I became interested in doing that job. So, I learned a lot through their leadership on these missions. And then, I decided, hey, that would be even cooler than being a FIDO, sure. would be to be a flight director. So I applied and was selected in 2007.
Okay.
And so I was able to work two shuttle flights as a flight director, and then I've supported space station operations for about 14 years. And it was just, again, an amazing experience. The best part of it was just all the different people you got to work with. As an individual console, like a FIDO, you're sort of specialized in one area. But as a flight director, you're sort of, you have to be quite familiar with all the systems and all right. the operations, whether it's, the part that I was most familiar with, orbital rendezvous and burns, doing maneuvers in space. But you also have to know spacewalks, robotics systems, repair of equipment on board the space station. Mm-hmm. All the different power, life support, and avionics on the space station. So that was a really fun part, was to, again, to get that broad understanding of how the whole vehicle works, and then to go be a part of the exciting missions on the space station. And especially, looking out the window and of the space station from the video to come into the mission control and, seeing this amazing machine that we built 250 miles up in the sky.
And so each flight director has a call sign, and there's usually a description or story behind that. What is yours?
Mine is Venture Flight. And so I chose that name to sort of capture the spirit of adventure that goes into space flight, and also that a venture is any kind of risk that you take, some kind of endeavor that you do where there's a great risk, but there's also a great payoff.
I love that. We're going to have to go look up the symbol, put it here in the show notes.
Oh, there's a patch to go with the symbol too. So, at NASA, we've got to have patches for everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so after flight director, you are now the acting manager of the Orion program's Vehicle Integration Office. Can you explain how that fits into the program as a whole and what your office is responsible for?
Sure. Yeah, before I do that, let me explain my transition. So, after about 14 years working ISS as a flight director, I was starting to think, hey, what would be the next phase of my career? And I was really interested in playing a bigger role in the Artemis program to return humans to the moon. And so, again, I saw another help wanted ad this time in the JSC Roundup, and I said, oh, that Vehicle Integration Office, it was for the deputy of that office, and I said, that sounds like something I'd be really interested in. So applied for that job, and they were also interested in my experience in operations and technical integration. So I started with Orion about 4 years ago, as deputy of Vehicle Integration, and now as the acting manager. So, to describe for you what role VIO plays, and that's Vehicle Integration. Integration means the sum of all the parts, and that's essentially what we do. We take all the individual systems of the Orion spacecraft and determine, with their constraints and operating limitations, what kind of missions can we fly. So, for example, how much power can we generate on a given launch date? What kind of propellant do we have available to use for the burns in space? How much air and water will the crew need on a particular mission? In fact, we come up with the manifest, everything that goes into the crew cabin, to make sure that all fits inside of Orion to last for, in the case of Artemis II, a 10-day mission, but even longer for Artemis III. Out, which is going to eventually land astronauts on the moon. So in vehicle integration, we perform the analysis to determine what kind of missions Orion can fly. We also, as part of our team, have our systems engineering and integration, or SENI team, and the systems engineering is essentially making sure that we're meeting all of the requirements that are imposed upon us. So as you can imagine, there are thousands of requirements to make sure that Orion can execute the mission safely. And so we have to prove that before we fly. We have to make sure we've done the analysis or the testing to show that each requirement is met. In some cases, you know, we might have come up short. Is that acceptable or not? So we have to process any of the waivers on those requirements. And then our systems engineering team also leads the entire program through our run-up to flight readiness review. Now, for Artemis II, that'll happen in December, but there's already starting reviews of each of the systems, and we will build up, and again, making sure that every single system is ready to go. So, and then there's a third part of our vehicle integration team, and that is our guidance, navigation, and control. And in engineering, we call that GNNC. So we develop the algorithms essentially to determine where Orion is in space. So there's no GPS out at the moon. So we have to do that through inertial navigation with our inertial measurement units and also radiometric tracking with the comm system. And then once you know where you are, you need to figure out, well, how do I get to where I want to be? How do I fly around the moon, at the right altitude? How do I get back to the Earth's atmosphere at just the right speed and the right angle? So that's the guidance. And so again, as you can imagine, very complex mathematics and orbital mechanics go into preparing those algorithms. And then the guidance computes when to fire the engines, how long to burn, what direction. That's the control. So that's GNNC, and that team prepares all of the software, works closely with our prime contractor, Lockheed Martin, to get those algorithms loaded into the software. And as well, they do the analysis to make sure when we have the mission plan ready, they fly those out and make sure that, we're not violating any constraints on the vehicle, like the G loads during entry or using too much propellant that we wouldn't, that we would not be able to accomplish the mission. So that's the big picture of what vehicle integration does for the Orion program.
That was fantastic. I'm here taking a whole bunch of notes. And so many full circle moments in your career. You mentioned that VO, or Vehicle Integration Office, is the sum of all parts. I like that. And kind of similar to what you did as flight director. So speaking of just overall integration, how would you say that? So we're gearing up for Artemis II, right? But it doesn't mean we aren't preparing for future missions, so Artemis III. And how does your role integrate with programs of the future? So think Artemis III with the human landing system and things like that.
Yeah, actually, that's a very important part of our systems engineering and integration team that I'd like to go into a little bit of detail on. So we have a cross-program integration team within vehicle integration, and they are responsible for establishing and negotiating the interfaces between the Orion spacecraft and the other programs. So, for example, for Artemis II, Orion is going to be riding into space mm-hmm. on top of a Space Launch System, an SLS rocket. So we need to make sure that the computers are speaking the same language to each other and exchanging data. So our cross-program integration team is responsible for doing that work. And when we fly Artemis III, Orion will dock with a human lander, an HLS lander built by SpaceX. So we'll dock out in lunar orbit. And again, as we're approaching and rendezvousing, we need to make sure that we've jointly agreed where we're going to rendezvous, what distance, what closing rate, who's going to do which burns to dock. Are there any limitations on attitude or the timeline for the rendezvous? And then again, can the radios speak to each other? Can the computer, once we get docked, make sure that the computers can send messages and data back and forth and telemetry to the ground? So that's everything that our cross-program integration team does. And sort of the dry part is it's all captured in interface control documents. So there's a lot of documentation, as you can imagine. The pictures look pretty on TV, but there's a lot of detailed engineering that goes on in the background, and that's what our cross-program team does.
Got it. Okay. Can you tell us about your role during Artemis I and what that entailed?
Yeah, Artemis I was that was the first full-up mission of an Orion spacecraft with our European Service Module, first ride that we took on the Space Launch System, and that was back in November of 2021. And my role supporting that mission was lead of the Mission Evaluation Room, or MER. So everyone's familiar with mission control, right? The flight sure. control team that you see on TV. And, if you've seen the Apollo 13 movie, when Houston, we have a problem, that's the team that answers that call. So again, as flight director, I was, very experienced working on that side of mission control. But most people probably don't know that there's supporting mission control. The flight ops team is the MER. And the MER is made up of the engineers from the program. So in the case of Artemis I, we built up a team. It was a total team of about 190 people. These were all the engineers and software developers from both NASA and Lockheed Martin and other contractors that had literally designed and built all the systems. They coded the software. They, you know, were there for the thousands of hours of testing. So they knew in intimate detail each of the components. So in the MER, you know, they're there to watch and see how the vehicle performs, to make notes of things we need to go look into or correct for next time or make better, and also to be there in case of problems. And we did have some anomalies, some mostly minor, but things during Artemis 1 that the MER worked closely with the flight ops team and the mission control. Actually, we were just right across the hall, and we're on the same loops, looking at the same displays, and working cooperatively to accomplish the mission successfully. So the way I like to describe the MER is, if mission control, if the flight ops team is the help desk, the MER is who the help desk calls when they need help.
That is so good and a great way to describe this. Okay, so yeah. Artemis 1 mission, uncrewed mission, first full-up mission of Orion. Now, what about for Artemis 2? What will you be doing for the mission coming up here shortly?
Yeah, so for Artemis 2, now I'm on the management team. There, you know, I will not be part of the MER per se, but I'll be participating with our Orion management team as we prepare each day for the daily Artemis mission management team, or MMT, meetings. So the flight director is in charge in real time of the mission to execute according to the flight plan and the flight rules. The flight director has authority to do whatever is necessary along with the crew commander to keep the crew safe. But for slowly developing issues, or maybe we need to consider changing up, you know, what we're going to do tomorrow or what the rest of the mission looks like, for more slowly developing issues, that will be brought up to the management team. And this has been done since, you know, Apollo and Space Shuttle as well, that, you know, there's a management team overseeing the operations. So the Orion program manager will have a seat at the MMT. And again, my role will be to assist with the other Orion managers to prepare our program manager, Howard Hugh, to support the meeting and to be ready to make recommendations and decisions about how Artemis 2 will be conducted.
Okay. Can you explain your role in a way that would make sense to someone who isn't familiar with Artemis or maybe isn't a space enthusiast?
So for Artemis 2, the day in the life of Artemis 2 will be, again, the flight ops team and mission control is overseeing the vehicle, planning the day's activities, advising the crew as they go through the timeline. The MER, the mission evaluation team, will be, again, monitoring the data, looking for any funnies. Is there a current maybe for a motor that's a little higher than it should be? Is there some software bug that has caused a computer to flake out? So we'll be looking at all those problems. And then the MER team will then bring those to the Orion management team, of which I'm a member. And we'll bring those issues, and we'll determine whether we need to change anything for the flight, whether there's any additional risk that we've got to sign up to, or if we should change that, you know, if we should bring the crew back early, or if we should continue on. So we will discuss internally within Orion at a meeting each day to prepare for, again, that mission management team meeting, which will ultimately make the decisions regarding how we conduct Artemis 2. And that MMT is chaired by the deputy for the Moon to Mars program.
Why are we going back to the moon?
Well, there's a lot of unfinished business from Apollo. We learned a lot about the geology of the moon and the history of the moon. The moon actually came from the Earth during a collision with a large Mars-sized body, we believe. So we learned a lot on Apollo, but there's a lot more to be learned. One thing we've discovered since Apollo is that there's evidence of ice in the South Pole region of the moon in permanently shadowed craters. So these are craters that have not seen sunlight for billions of years. And so we believe that comets and maybe other, you know, orbital bodies from the beginning of the solar system have deposited water essentially on the South Pole of the moon. So that, if that's true, that will become one of the most valuable pieces of real estate in the solar system, because water is like gold in space. You can use it to drink, or you can split the water into hydrogen and oxygen, and that, of course, is rocket fuel, like the shuttle main engines used hydrogen and oxygen, and also oxygen to breathe. So we want to go to the South Pole of the moon. It's a very difficult region to get to, very rugged terrain, but we want to find if there's these resources we can use on the moon in order to support a human habitation. And also, why do you go back to the moon? We eventually, NASA's goal is to take humans out into, the solar system and eventually the stars. And so in order to, for example, to be able to live and work on Mars, we first, it's much safer and easier to do it on a relatively close by orbital body, the moon. So let's, that's the benefit of going to the moon. Just like if you were going to run a marathon, you wouldn't put on your running shoes and immediately go out and run 26 miles. You would probably start with a run a mile and then run a 5K and a half marathon. So let's say going to the moon is our half marathon to get ready to go for Mars.
Okay. Well, let's get into the spacecraft itself, not literally. Let's talk about it. We're recording this episode in August of 2025, and just last week, the crew suited up and went inside the spacecraft for the first time in their suits to test all the interfaces. So mission's coming up next year. Can you give our listeners the high-level elevator description of the spacecraft? So how many passengers can it carry, for how long, size comparison, things like that. And you can pretend this is a really tall building, and it doesn't have to be just a few floors. It can be a couple floors up. Okay. It doesn't have to be that quick.
All right. Well, so Orion is essentially America's deep space crew transportation vehicle. So it's going to ride on top of a space launch system or SLS rocket from the launch pad up into Earth orbit. And then the space launch system will, the upper stage will send it on its way to the moon. And so the crew will be riding in Orion. Four crew members can fit inside the spacecraft. It's about 60% larger than Apollo. It's the same shape as Apollo because, again, the physics have not really changed since the 1960s. So that's an efficient shape, lightweight, and minimizes the area that we have to protect of the thermal protection system. So the crew will ride, in the case of Artemis II, it's about a four-day trip out to the moon. It could be longer for some of the later missions. They will ride in Orion and rendezvous in lunar orbit, eventually on Artemis III, with the lander. And so the lander will take the crew down to the lunar surface, where they'll spend about a week down doing, moonwalks and conducting experiments on the moon. Meanwhile, Orion will remain in orbit around the moon with two of the crew members doing experiments and making observations of the moon. And then when the lander comes back up, again, about a week later, it will rendezvous with Orion in lunar orbit. The crew will transfer back to all four crew to Orion, and then Orion will depart lunar orbit and head back to the Earth. So again, for Artemis II, about a four-day trip back to the Earth. And then the last important role of Orion is to provide a safe reentry and landing, just like Apollo, under parachutes in the Pacific Ocean. In this case, it'll be off the coast of San Diego.
Okay, really informative elevator ride. Thank you for that overview of the spacecraft itself. So let's dive a little more, quote, under the hood and talk about the spacecraft's three main components. And let's go from top to bottom. So let's start with the launch abort system. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, we call that the LAS. So it's a solid rocket motor that's mounted on top of the capsule. And it's designed, if there's a problem with the rocket in about the first 3 minutes of the launch, or even on the launch pad, if there was, for example, a fire or the rocket was losing control, rates or attitude goes out of limits, that there's an emergency detection system. The software will automatically abort the mission. The crew also has an abort switch that they can engage manually. And so that LAS is like a very fast rocket ride away from your rocket to take the crew away from whatever bad things are happening back on the SLS. And it will take them away and then release the capsule, and then the parachutes will come out and Orion would land safely in the ocean. So it's a similar system to what we had with Apollo. The Russians have actually used this on their Soyuz before. So they had a fire before a launch and they did a safe last type abort. So it's definitely an improvement over what we had on the space shuttle in terms of providing a safe abort option for the crew.
You mentioned almost like a rocket launch in itself. And I remember, were you down in Florida for Ascent Abort 2 or AA2?
Oh, I've seen it on YouTube,
oh,
but I was not
gosh.
There.
Yeah. I was not expecting that to be as big as it was, right? Going down from, okay, launch abort system on the top, then going down to the middle, so to speak, so the crew module, that's the pressurized part, sometimes called the capsule. Can you talk about
that? Right, so that's where the crew's going to ride. I mentioned earlier it's about 60% larger than Apollo. I was looked up the cubic feet. It's about the size of a small camper van, if you've seen one of those on a video. So it's small for four people. It's going to be you're going to be pretty getting to know each other very well. But the nice thing is in microgravity you can use the ceiling and the walls, so sure. You're not just limited to the floor. So inside the capsule or the four seats that the crew will ride during launch and landing, they'll stow those. When they're done, they'll take their suits, their launch and entry suits off and stow those as well. So create a little bit of extra room. There are storage compartments for all their food and clothes and extra tools that might be needed. There's a water distribution system, so they'll be eating food similar to what the crew eats on the space station. So just sort of like being on a camping trip, that kind of thing. There's an exercise, a flywheel. So essentially it's a box with, a flywheel. They can do curls. They can do squats. So any number of exercises, again, to get the heart rate going while they're flying around the moon, and also to keep their strength up and sort of to avoid some of those debilitating effects of microgravity. And there's also a toilet. We call it the Universal Waste Management System, or UWMS. We have an acronym for everything, as you know. So it's located in the floor of Orion. It's in one of the compartments. So actually it's about the size of a small phone booth for the listeners that remember what phone booths were back in the day. But you open that door and go down into the floor, and there's a little bitty, a really small toilet that it uses a pump to provide some suction to do the things that gravity does for us here on Earth. And then there's a fecal can that holds the solid waste, and that'll, yeah, once that's filled up, that'll be sealed off and just returned to Earth with the crew. But that's how the toilet works. And let's see what other systems should I describe. I guess there's sleeping bags that the crew will sleep in at night, and all the other things you would expect to have in a spacecraft to do the human hygiene. And little tablet computers to monitor the flight plan, and of course all the displays and controls that are needed to fly the spacecraft, and four big windows to enjoy the view.
Cool. Okay, and then moving on to the service module, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's another really exciting part of the Orion program, is that it's not just the U.S. Just as we have with the International Space Station, we have a large component of international partners working with us. So for the European service module for Orion, it's actually built in Germany by the European Space Agency. And so it provides the power through four solar arrays and the propulsion through a main engine and eight auxiliary thrusters, and then about 24 auxiliary thrusters or RCS thrusters on the ESM in order to steer Orion and keep it pointed in the right direction so that we can get sunlight on our arrays. So again, manufactured by the European Space Agency. So we have an office within the Orion program that does all the interfacing for the ESM. And it also provides our heat rejection capability. So the ESM is sort of the utilities to keep the crew safe and comfortable.
Okay, that was a great overview of the three main components, so the launch abort system, the crew module, and the European service module. Where are all these components manufactured? You talked about it a little bit with the service module, but what other agency centers and contractors are involved?
Yeah, so our prime contractor is Lockheed Martin. So their headquarters for Orion is out in Denver, Colorado. So that's where a lot of the engineering and some of the early components are built up. But the spacecraft itself is assembled at Kennedy Space Center. And so the parts come together from all over the country and as I mentioned earlier, all over the world, really. So there's many, I don't know, have the exact number, but there's many subcontractors that provide parts. In terms of the NASA centers that are participating, the Glenn Research Center up in Cleveland, Ohio, is where our European interface office is located that interfaces for the European service module. So that's where our propulsion experts reside. And then at Langley, Langley helped lead the launch abort system development along with Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama. And Marshall has also done a lot of our life support system development. Of course, Kennedy Space Center is where it all comes together and where we launch. And then finally at Ames Research Center out in California, we've used their ArcJet test facility to test our heat shield materials. So it's definitely a joint effort throughout the country and indeed the world.
Okay, and so of course Artemis 1 was uncrewed. What did we learn about the spacecraft?
Yeah, Artemis 1 was the first time that we had flown the entire, you know, integrated Orion with the service module and the LAS on top of a space launch system. So it was the first flight of that integrated stack. And so the first thing we learned was that the SLS worked great, and overall the vehicle control, computers, telemetry, communication, all of that worked fantastic. So a lot of good results coming out of Artemis 1. There were a few little glitches, like on one of our power conversion and distribution units that passes power from the solar arrays to the spacecraft. It had some glitches where these essentially solid-state switches would occasionally trip open. And so, of course, we had redundant power, so we didn't lose any critical systems. But definitely needed to understand why that was happening. And so that was an example of a case where the MER, the mission evaluation room, was heavily involved in terms of psyching out that problem. And we've determined that it was actually caused by radiation hits on some of the electrical components within that box. So that's we're going to fix that for Artemis 3, and we've put in fault detection software for Artemis 2 that will more quickly recover from that if we see that occur again. So that was just an example of the type of glitches we saw during the mission. The probably one that some of the listeners are familiar with is what we learned about our heat shield performance on the landing. So one difference between Orion and Apollo is that Apollo did a direct entry. So essentially, wherever whatever point you're going to impact with the ocean or land on the ocean is fixed when you leave the moon. There's very little control of that. The Apollo and the Orion do not have wings like a space shuttle, so you can't steer left or right or uprange or downrange very well. So not a lot of ability to avoid a storm if you're coming back. And so one thing a new capability with Orion is we've got the ability to do what's called a skip entry, where we sort of bounce off the atmosphere a little bit and skip further downrange and then come into our desired landing site. So sort of like taking a flat rock and skipping it across a pond. So and the reason we do that, of course, is so we can skip over any bad weather and sort of pick downrange where we want to land, again, for safety for the crew. But what we found with Artemis 1 was that in doing that skip, it created a char layer on the sort of a burned layer on the outside of the heat shield during the cooler part of the entry, relatively cooler part, and it allowed gases, heat, to build up inside the heat shield as we descended back in the second time, and that excess heat in some cases caused little chunks of the heat shield to pop off. Now, fortunately for Artemis 1, that char loss was not significant enough to cause any excess heating of the structure. The spacecraft landed perfectly fine, but it's definitely something that we needed to understand. So again, we did extensive arc jet testing, heat testing of the heat shield material in order to create this problem. And once we were able to create it on the ground and through analysis modeling with simulations, then we knew we had understood the problem and it matched very well with what we observed on Artemis 1. So what we're doing for Artemis 2, the heat shield was already built, so we're going to fly Artemis 2 with the heat shield as is, but we're going to go back to doing sort of an Apollo-style entry. We're going to do a direct entry. We do have a little bit of capability to vary that landing site, uprange or downrange, if we have to avoid any weather systems, but we will not do the full up to 4,800 nautical miles is what mm-hmm. capability we eventually want to have with Artemis 3. Artemis 3 will, that heat shield is being manufactured now, and we've adjusted the recipe for that Avcoat material so that we don't have this problem on Artemis 3 and beyond.
Okay. And so for Artemis 2, it would not, so direct entry is not that flat rock skipping across.
We're not skipping. We're going straight in. Yep.
That was a great way to describe that. Okay.
Yeah, and by going straight in, we'll allow the heat to bleed off steadily, and we won't build up those pockets of heat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about demonstrating the spacecraft's capabilities, this time with crew on board. But first, episode 394, we did look at a detailed look at the mission. But for our listeners here, can you provide a quick overview of the mission profile?
Yeah, Jeff Radigan did a great job describing the mission in that episode. But yeah, just a quick recap. So the Space Launch System, SLS, will launch Orion and the crew up to a 1,200 nautical mile apogee right off the bat, which is amazing because, again, space station orbits about 250 miles up. So SLS has got lots of power to spare. And so about 1 hour, 45 minutes into the mission, the upper stage of SLS is called the ICPS for Interim Cryogenic Propulsion Stage. It will boost the apogee or the high point of the orbit up to about 39,000 miles. So now we're really way up. The crew's going to get a great view up there. So and so Orion will separate from the ICPS, and then about 3 hours into the mission, we'll perform a proximity operations demonstration. We call it ProxOps demo. And what they'll do is essentially, as they're separating from that upper stage, they'll stop the opening rate, turn around, and point the nose back to that stage. And then they'll fly in and practice maneuvering around that stage, get, you know, basically flying the stick to exercise the, and, you know, to see how the handling characteristics of the capsule match what we've modeled in simulations. So once we're done with that, then the crew will be, will separate finally from the ICPS. It'll be disposed of, you know, in the ocean. Orion will continue up for about 1 day on what we call the high Earth orbit, or HEO. A few hours after that demo, they'll go to sleep. And in the meanwhile, in mission control and in the mission evaluation room, the MER, we will be closely monitoring their systems to determine, is everything working okay so that we can commit to send the crew to the moon. So that commit decision is about 1 day and 1 hour. It's the TLI, or translunar injection burn, and that's where we'll fire the main engine on the European service module that will give Orion that final boost to leave the Earth and head out to the moon. And in the case of Artemis II, we will not orbit the moon. We're going to be on a free return trajectory. So we'll pass about 5,000 miles behind the moon and then start falling back to Earth. And again, about after about 9 days of the mission, we'll reenter the Earth and come in for that landing off the coast of San Diego.
Great. Okay. Now, with crew on board for the mission, what elements are we testing that differ from Artemis 1? You did talk about ProxOps a little bit. Let's start with that. So what new pieces of hardware were added to Orion for this?
Yeah, so we're going to be flying our docking camera. And so the crew will install that on the in Orion. I didn't mention it earlier, but there's an overhead hatch, as you would expect, because to transfer from Orion to the lunar lander, you've got to, just like in Apollo, you've got to pass through a hatch into the other vehicle. So there's a window on that hatch, and they will mount a camera that is going to be used for to provide a sort of a nose-on view of the ICPS, and for Artemis III, of the docking target on the lunar lander. Mm-hmm. And we'll also be flying a compact flight computer, or CFC, that's going to interface with that docking camera. And that will display, that will allow the camera imagery and the overlays, which are essentially grids, on the crew display. So the crew will have all the information right there in front of them on their control panel as they're flying around the ICPS. So that's what we'll exercise as part of that ProxOps demo.
Okay. And then, of course, with humans on board, life support systems are very important. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so the piece of hardware that everyone's going to be watching the most closely will be our atmosphere revitalization system. So for Artemis 1, we had a pressure control system. It maintained, you know, habitable temperatures within the cabin. But for Artemis 2, we're flying new hardware to provide CO2 removal and humidity removal for the crew. So the box is called the CHC, carbon dioxide humidity controller. There's three CHCs, and they are regenerative CO2 removal systems. So with Shuttle and Apollo, we used non-renewable systems, essentially canisters of lithium hydroxide, or LiO canisters, and we would pass air over those, and it would chemically react with the CO2, remove that from the atmosphere, and then the crew would, you know, breathe easy. Yeah. But again, it's not reusable. So as you use them up, they create space and waste, right, and more weight. So for Orion, again, to have longer capability of flying, we wanted a regenerative system. So we've tested this technology. It's an amine swing bed, carbon dioxide adsorption bed. So it essentially, I think of it as a molecular sponge, where you flow air over it, it grabs the CO2 and the humidity out of the air, and then after a certain period of time, once it's saturated, you expose it to the vacuum of space, and that CO2 and humidity are relieved overboard. And so you can just switch back and forth between two beds, one absorbing and one regenerating continually. And it will, you know, keep the air clean for the crew to not have excess levels of CO2. And hat tip to the space station, because we test a lot of this technology over the years on board the space station. So we'll be watching very closely how the CHCs work, especially in the first rev, that high Earth orbit. Well, you know, if things are not going well, you know, we're always thinking, what do we do? What if, right? What if they're not working, we can bring the crew back safely. We are flying enough contingency LIO canisters, actually old shuttle canisters, that can get us through the first day. So if we do have problems, we can bring them back safely from that high Earth orbit using the old school technology. But again, we've done a lot of testing with the CHCs, and assuming they are working right, we will press on with our translunar injection burn about one day into the mission. And so that the ECLIS system also introduces some new problems for us. The venting, I mentioned how that mm-hmm. the CO2 is vented overboard. We're also going to, with the toilet, the UWMS, yeah. The urine dumps, we have a urine tank, so we'll vent that overboard. So all those things, my Fido friends and all the trajectory people hate the venting and the dumping overboard. So it's going to perturb the trajectory somewhat. So that's another thing we're going to be watching closely, is tracking the orbit and doing orbit correction burns. We've got at least one per day budgeted throughout the mission in order to correct the trajectory, make sure that we are staying on track to hit the right speed and angle when Orion contacts the atmosphere.
Okay, and so with crew on board, prox ops, life support systems, what about communication systems?
Yeah, so we're flying the same communication system as we did in Artemis 1, with one exception. We actually have an emergency comm system, which is totally separate from our S-band system. We have two strings, two independent S-bands, and then we have a third fully independent emergency comm system. It doesn't provide telemetry, but it's voice only, and it will be used if both of the prime radios fail. At least the crew will be able to talk to Earth, and we can, again, uplink by voice any information they need to get them back safely. And if that were to fail, we've got yet another system. We've got an optical navigation system. Apollo did not have the capability to return autonomously, but Orion does have that capability. It can take, that system takes, essentially it's a digital camera, takes images of the moon and the Earth, and it uses that to compute where it is between the two.
Wow.
And it can update the navigation state in order to return you safely, even if you completely lost communication with the Earth. So again, we've built in a lot of capabilities for crew safety into Orion. And then the final, you know, big new thing with Artemis 2 would be the displays and controls, and the fact that we've got now the crew interacting with the vehicle automation. We tested out the automation extensively on Artemis 1, and you know, thousands and thousands of hours of testing in Denver at their facility. But you know, this will be the first time with the crew again taking the vehicle automation through all its paces and how they interact using the displays and controls. So that'll be another big, you know, learning opportunity for us on Artemis 2.
What message do you want to share to your teams ahead of the mission?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a manager, so my message, as you know, the past many months has been, let's get the work done, because the vehicle hardware is going to be ready to fly early next year, and we've got to have all of our analysis and verifications complete so that we can prove it's safe to fly. And so that work has to get done first and foremost. So the team is really working hard. I should mention that, you know, being part of Orion is really amazing. I came from the operations world, where of course I had great respect for the astronauts and the flight controllers that go fly these missions. But when I came to Orion, I was so impressed with the quality and the dedication of the engineers that, again, are designing the individual components, the depth of their knowledge and dedication to make sure that, you know, every little aspect of how the systems work is understood, and they're excited and ready to go, you know, support the mission, you know, many of them in the MER as part of that team. So usually for the team, I'm just emphasizing, let's get the work done. But also, I know they're like me, that, you know, at night when they look up at the moon, just like when I was a kid, it's exciting to look up at the moon and think, wow, you know, we're going to be heading back, and this time I'm a part of that.
what do you want people to know about Orion? So what would you like our listeners to take away from this episode?
Well, I want, you know, as an engineer, of course, I'm most interested in how the system's going to work.
Yeah.
You know, how's the crew? What kind of feedback are we going to get from the crew? What things did we learn that we need to correct for next time? So, you know, that's the part that the engineer and the Orion program team member that I'm most interested in. But really, the part that, you know, I hope everyone takes away from it is just the excitement of, you know, we're finally going to be returning humans to the vicinity of the moon for the first time in 50 years. So I think it's just, I think it's just great to be a part of human exploration and taking those next steps. And this is nothing new. You know, NASA is not in a new business. Humans have been exploring since frankly we stepped out of trees, you know, on the plains of Africa, and eventually leaving Africa in waves of immigration to all four corners of the Earth, right? From the in the Ice Age up to Europe, the people that settled America coming across the Bering Ice Bridge, and those that settled, you know, even going out into Polynesia across the ocean. So humans just explore, and America, you know, we were founded by explorers. And so NASA is continuing that great tradition. So I'm proud to be part of the Orion program, and all of us are excited to be getting ready to return humans back to the moon.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for sticking around. I hope you learned something new today. You can check out the latest from around the agency at nasa.gov and keep up with the Orion spacecraft and its Artemis II journey at nasa.gov/Orion. Our full collection of episodes and all the other wonderful NASA podcasts can be found at nasa.gov/podcast. On social media, we're on the NASA Johnson Space Center pages of Facebook, X, and Instagram. If you have questions for us or suggestions for future episodes, email us at nasa-houstonpodcast@mail.nasa.gov. This episode was recorded on August 6, 2025. Our producer is Dane Turner. Audio engineers are Daniel Tohill and Will Flato. Our social media is managed by Kelsey Howren and Reagan Sharpetter. Houston, We Have a Podcast was created and is supervised by Gary Jordan. Special thanks to Rad Zinyak and Erica Peters for helping us plan and set up this interview. And of course, thanks again to Chris Edelin for taking the time to join us on the show. Give us a rating and feedback on whatever platform you're listening to us on, and tell us what you think of our podcast. We'll be back next week.
3, 2, 1.
This is an official NASA podcast.